Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is the man who loves chocolate because he buys very unique chocolate. Actually, that's actually a true thing.
Is it?
It is. Spencer Wonka Williams.
I don't know if I agree with you on that
assessment. You do. Those chocolate bars that you buy, the ones that I got you for Christmas, those are, I've never seen them in like regular stores.
They're so. Sprouts.
They're Tony Chocolone.
You know what?
They're in Raley's.
Yes.
Speaking of interrupting an A&B conversation, also with us today is intern and Oompa Loompa of the Most High, Amy.
That's really bad coming from somebody who worked in a candy store and can speak to most of the chocolate.
She's talking about herself, by the way. That's not helping her character. Either way, we have a great show in store as we are capping the season of suffering this year with a review of a film we were actually quite on the fence for. But oddly enough, you'll find out our thoughts as soon as we get into our review of Wonka. So stick around as we dive into that. But before we do, Spencer, why don't you give them opening credits?
Tune in each and every Thursday. On all your favorite streaming platforms and over our website at filmlosophers.com. Also, connect with us on the social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101.
That's right. We got a website at filmlosophers.com. We allegedly have over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy. Our last time we did our season of suffering, you can check it out. What?
2021.
From 2021, we skipped a year because good things happened last December. But check it out over at our website, filmlosophers.com. You can also check us out wherever podcasts are streaming, and that's iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, or iHeart. You can tune into each and every one of those places. Find us there at The Filmlosophers. Give us a follow or a subscribe. Let us know how we're doing. Drop us a line in the comment section down below, and if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it!
We have.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, we have. And we will give you more of them social links at the end of the episode. We obviously are capping off our opportunity to do our season of suffering with a movie that we actually thought we were going to suffer through. And oddly enough, we'll give you how that wrapped out when we do the review. But in the spirit of the film and how, if you've seen the original films or the adaptations, you do know that things do get a little nonsensical at times. So we're going to insert our little segment here of Amy's nonsensical non sequiturs, because apparently she has non sequiturs, because she's obviously got some things that she wants to present to the table, questions that will defy logic and honestly probably maybe infuriate Spencer and I, maybe just me.
But mostly you.
Mostly me. Yeah. So I'm going to throw it over to Amy, and she hasn't told us what these were. Spencer, do you know what any of these questions are?
No.
These are odd, weird, according to what Amy mentioned, icebreakers? Like, apparently we don't know enough of each other that we need to have an icebreaker.
Oh, you can always learn more about people.
This is what happens when we gave her that opportunity to coordinate the office Christmas party, and she tries to do things like it's.
How did a Christmas party turn into a variety of questions?
That's what HR is asking. So
hey,
Christmas party
was Love Actually.
That
was a party for nobody.
That was a party for everyone and nobody.
Love Actually was torture. So why don't you go ahead and drop us your questions here.
All right. So first one is, what's the best way to start your day?
Is this a Folgers commercial?
No, that's the first thing I wanted to ask.
We're going to have to regroup and let's stop the podcast and start all over. What's the best way to start your day? You wake up. Yeah, if you don't wake up, guess what?
That's also my answer, is waking up.
Yeah, literally, like you get up. And if you got up, then okay.
You've made it.
Yeah, exactly.
You're here.
Exactly. I mean, there's no real Anybody, here's my thoughts. Anybody who has an answer to this outside of what we just said is doing way too much.
Hey, do you have an answer to this?
No, waking up was like,
this is like one of those situations where it's like, well, when I get up, I do my yoga stretches and I make sure
I'm thankful and I count to 10 and I take a deep breath.
Someone just says they play Pink from Barbie.
Oh my gosh. You have other questions,
yes,
right?
I do.
Okay, thank God.
Okay. You come into possession of an illegal giraffe. How do you go
about How do you go
it?
From asking about how we start our morning?
Isn't this like one of those interview questions?
No.
Because like I feel like I heard a version of this where it's like, you are given an elephant. You cannot return this elephant. What are you doing with the elephant?
No. I guess you come into possession of an illegal giraffe. How do you go about hiding
an
it?
Illegal
giraffe. Wait. Why am I hiding the giraffe?
Because he's illegal.
So
you turn him into the police. This is the correct answer.
No, I think
I like sensors.
I think we're missing the more important question. What did the giraffe do that was illegal? Are we harboring an illegal individual?
Murdered several people.
Right? Act of having the giraffe illegal? Or is it
part of the giraffe mafia?
Like, exactly. Is he the giraffe? Is he part of like the mob boss? Is he one of the higher ups?
Is he the giraffe boss?
He's part of the Yakuza. Can you imagine a giraffe in a kimono? A Japanese giraffe in a kimono.
Oh, so how are you hiding him?
Look, I'm from Texas. More than likely, I'm going to find a way to eat them and like deep fry. I mean, you know, because honestly, I mean, what are you going to do with something that's taller than most people's houses? You know, you're
hiding it's very hard.
Yeah. I mean, unless you like fold him in half. And then if you fold him in half, he's ultimately dead.
Yes.
So with you have a dead animal, you might as well figure out a way to, you know,
just consume them.
I mean, if it's not like a dog or a cat or something, it's, you know, it's an exotic animal. I'm pretty sure I could make some giraffe burgers, make a couple bucks off of that. I'm just saying.
So you will eat them, and that's how you hide them.
I just got something. He's avoiding the long neck of the law. thank you. I'll be here all day.
Cha-cha-cha. So he'll eat him, Spencer. What about you?
Not turning him into the police.
Okay, yeah, like, it's turning into.
I don't know
who this is. Justice consumption.
They just showed up.
Spencer's
goodbye.
Like, I'm a black man in the United States. I do not need any other strikes
don't
against me.
Don't add draft onto that.
Right.
Amy, what are you doing with this draft?
Well, the just ridiculous of me goes, give him a wig and send him on his way, or release him into the
wild.
How
are you going to get all the way up there to his head to give him a wig?
I mean, maybe if I'm polite enough or I have a really long stick. I could distract him.
You're
going
to stab him with a stick to
just,
make sure?
No.
What if you poke out his eye? Then he's going to be a one-eyed giraffe. He's a one-eyed mob boss giraffe from Japan.
See? And then that way, when he really is on the run, like, or I'd try to release him into the wild, but that wouldn't go very well. They'd find him immediately. And then they'd be like,
what wild are you going to release him into?
The wilds world. Of Sacramento?
Yeah.
Right? Downtown,
do you
mean?
Little kids would be so excited.
Are you kidding?
Oh, my gosh.
The homeless people would get to him first before anybody else. And then it's, you think my idea was bad? They'll. Yeah, it's like The Walking Dead around here sometimes. So just saying.
Okay.
Your questions.
Okay. Man. Okay. So this is the last one, so then we can move on. But I liked the draft one. It was weird. You meet the perfect person. Romantically, this person is ideal. You find them physically attractive, intellectually stimulating, consistently funny, and deeply compassionate. However, there's one quirk. This individual is obsessed with Jim Henson's gothic puppet fantasy, The Dark Crystal. Beyond watching it on DVD at least once a month, they pepper casual conversation with Dark Crystal references, using Dark Crystal analogies to explain everyday
events.
This is
a dumb question.
And occasionally likes to talk intensely about the film's deeper philosophy. Would this be enough to stop you from marrying them?
This is a dumb question because we're nerds here.
Yeah.
So it's like,
but
that's
once a month, I was like, oh, that's
this
not
question,
bad at all.
Right? Once a month? You thought it too? I was like, oh,
this question
only once?
Seems like it was written by somebody who refers to Lord of the Rings as that movie about the ring. Like, that's this is
that
a question that is not. This wasn't derived by somebody who actually is a nerd like us. This question is more of like to pick at and to point out the people who do, because honestly, I can be completely genuine in saying I know several people. They might they're definitely not like the one, the whatever you called
the
it
one.
But their lifestyles and whatnot revolve around either certain franchises or even this particular franchise. And it's like, hey, you know, you do you. If that's your fandom, knock, you know, knock yourself out. I mean, we're like that with Star Wars, Back to the Future, Star Trek. I mean, with books, there are certain books that people are like, you know, head over heels, and they go on and on. Musicals, Broadways, comic books. This is, I feel targeted.
This is the hyper, like, specific that you have. I guess it's the conundrum of maybe you're not super into the Dark Crystal. Maybe, much like you, as you recommended last week, you're a Muppet Christmas Carols man. And once a month for the rest of your lifetime, you know you will be watching the Dark Crystal with this partner. Do you still continue to marry them?
Yeah.
Because they're going to make you watch it too.
Yeah, that's fine.
That's fine.
I love you guys. Like, this,
this question, this I honestly thought the watch recurrence was going to be daily.
I thought and it I was like, too.
No, yeah. Not daily. That's 2 hours of my day. Like, I only get 24.
We're nerds here. So like this is more of like you needed to pose this as like, oh, this person is a huge, you know, Bravo Channel fan, and they only watch all of the whatever, or, you know, and they, you know, I mean, something like that would make this is along the lines of like literally our regular life. Like, yeah, each of
even
us,
even that
have.
Bravo Channel thing, I was like, well, what are we watching? Yeah. If it's something like that's like ridiculous in its own like inconsistent, maybe.
You mean
maybe.
Like Eddie and the OC? What? You like the OC? I don't even know.
That's even relevant to this conversation.
No, because
anyway,
apparently, to Amy, the OC is like Bravo.
Apparently, something I mean, like that. But like, it's one of those situations. Something that would have made this question a little bit better would probably have been like, you know, oh, they are fans of the show called My Strange Addiction, and they love to least they watch the show once a week, and they like to try one of the Strange Addictions a month.
Absolutely
and
not.
So that's a good question for the table, rather than like, these guys are nerds. Would you like spending time with other nerds? It's like, we are nerds, so.
Yeah, so fits in.
Intern, better research. So,
give her 5 minutes.
Give her two out of three.
You gave me less than.
She had two. That's a 66%. She's, yeah.
Well, there was another one about like you're the, coincidentally, like on the same day, a collection of Scottish marine biologists capture a living Loch Ness monster. And somewhere in the Northwest, a hiker comes across Bigfoot and he's amicable. And then the last one is like, oh,
what, what is this, like, well, cryptid Avengers or something?
Apparently. And then it was the last one was the president announces that he has thyroid cancer and he's going to surgery next week.
So you're are these all just separate?
Which one's going on the front page?
See, that's a good question. I like that question. That one has more bearing to like our thought process and mode of analysis than like, this person's a nerd. Can you spend time with them? It's like, yeah, we can spend. I mean, I'd watch it with them. I like the Dark Crystal. Like, what's wrong with that? But yeah.
Yeah, but so.
Two out of three. You're okay.
Okay. That's great. So you didn't decide who was going to be on your front page. Okay.
Oh, it depends. Where's the, which newspaper?
It's your New York Times. What goes on? What's the biggest story of the day for your front page?
Politically, it would have to be the president.
What was happening with the president?
Okay, so defying all expectation, a group of Scottish marine biologists capture a living
Loch Ness. So Loch Ness is captured, the Bigfoot's captured, and the president has...
And the president announces he has thyroid cancer. So that happens in the morning is the Loch Ness monster. Midday is the Sasquatch or Bigfoot, and he's in captivity. And then the evening, president says that he's got thyroid cancer and he's undergoing a biopsy later that week. What's the front page?
Obviously,
for
the
you
president.
Tomorrow?
Like, economically and politically, without creating a panic, because you need more proof and evidence to make sure that everything is on the up and up for those other two. The president is the one that you can definitively have information based on doctors and, you know, readily available so that you can run that story. Everything else could be like your online blog, you know, for the New York Times.
Okay, so this wholly depends on what you mean by morning. Morning, yeah. Here in New York or morning in Scotland? Because there could be enough of a time difference, because I don't know the time zones off the top of my head.
Yeah, but so the New York Times is a very, it's a very pretentious outlet. So you're going to want to make sure that whatever you put out there is not only definitively 100% accurate and evidence is on point, but it also is presented in a light that isn't demeaning to the paper altogether or to the publications. So you're going to want to sit on those first two for a little bit, at least give it enough time. Let TMZ take on the cryptids.
TMZ, they're not going to do anything with that.
But you have to run the president's information like
but
that.
But that's going to be at night. That's going to be the next day's paper.
Yeah, they're all going to be the next day's paper.
Not necessarily.
The New York Times drops in the morning.
Yeah, I know.
So you're saying you're going to create a whole new publication just for the midday just to get all your other stuff?
We're talking about when is the morning time of Scotland versus New York. That's what the question is.
Well, she didn't say what time zone it was that morning.
Yes, that's why I said that's the main question. Now I know who wasn't listening when I was talking.
Oh! He told you. So, yeah. There you go.
It's unfortunate you had to come up with extra ones because that other one flopped. But anyway.
So mean to me. All this is happening again. At least I have more voice this week. Last week was...
She's not Marge Simpson this week.
Yeah, running up that hill over there.
There you go. No, I like the question. I just think it needs a little bit more information to kind of create more of a substantiary.
Yeah, like what time zone?
Yeah. But apparently the question doesn't provide that, so.
No, it doesn't.
That's a good question. Next time, intern, go with those kinds of questions. Not like, how do you start your morning? With Folgers. We're sponsored this today. By
That would be a very great segue.
That would be a great segue.
If they were paying us enough. Yes. Or well, if there was a coffee that's guy what that he's saying. Us.
If there was...
It could be.
I just said sponsor.
That's not my department.
Speaking of segue, we're going to go ahead and transition over to our conversation of the evening as we cap off another season of suffering with a review of a film that we were really on the fence about, much to our dismay, and that is our review of 2023's Wonka. Honestly, this movie was something that we were actually all kind of apprehensive to talk about, but through the holiday spirit and the gifting of movie tickets, we ended up going to go see this movie. And so before I go any further, Spencer, why don't you give us that official synopsis goodness?
With dreams of opening a shop in a city renowned for its chocolate, a young and poor Willy Wonka discovers that the industry is run by a cartel of greedy chocolatiers.
Directed by Paul King, who co-wrote the screenplay with Simon Farnaby, based on a story by King, the film stars Timothée Chalamet in the title role and an ensemble cast including Kayla Lane, Keegan-Michael Key, Peterson Joseph, Matt Lucas, Matthew Bainton, Sally Hawkins, Rowan Atkinson, Jim Carter, Natasha Rothwell, Olivia Colman, and Hugh Grant. Written, produced, and directed by the same team as the Paddington films, the cast features many of the Paddington alumni. So there's a slew of folks that are in this film that are consistently in the other two films that Paul King did prior to Wonka. Mm-hmm. Which, if you have been listening to us for any length of time, you know that Amy speaks oodles and oodles of Paddington 2, yes, and then was 100%. Righteously... validated by the what is that movie?
The Unbearable Weight of Unbearable Massive Weight. Talent.
Yeah,
yes, it was
by none other than Pedro Pascal,
and then backed up
by Nicolas Cage.
So I can't, and then it spun into the Twitterverse, and like, oh shoot, if you haven't, you need to, and I'm like, yes, thank you. Thank you, universe. You just plop in the good things when I need them.
Which she had been pushing the table here to watch it quite frequently. And I saw it a couple years ago at your request.
And then for my birthday, I made you both watch it again.
Yes.
Yes.
Another quick note, Tom Holland and Timothée Chalamet were the two finalists for the role of Willy Wonka, with Chalamet ultimately winning the role. That would have been very interesting to have Tom Holland in the role of Willy Wonka. I mean, Timothée Chalamet in the role of Willy Wonka was already weird enough at the casting.
True.
But I don't know how much I would have... I don't know. It would have really had to push the levels of disbelief for Tom Holland. Mostly because, I mean, he's unfortunately fell into the Robert Downey Jr. syndrome where you look at him and you see the character that he's been playing. You know, so he is Spider-Man. Like, you look at him and it's like, oh, it's Spider-Man. So, yeah, you know. One other piece of information. Timothée Chalamet admitted he was initially skeptical of the film. He was quoted as saying, like many people, when there are remakes, I feel very protective over the original character and versions you love. Your eyebrows go up with skepticism about whether this is a legitimate, worthwhile story or a cynical money grab. End quote.
Which is all of us, let's be very honest.
I was just going to say, yeah, that sentiment was felt by every single person across the board. Anybody who heard of the casting, not only heard of the casting, but heard that they were creating this film. You know, this movie really kind of, it made a lot of people unsettled because of the fact that the last time we had anybody step into the role of Willy Wonka in an adaptation, we got the Tim Burton nightmare.
Which we also need to address that it was not endorsed by the Roald Dahl estate at all. Like, they were like, no, Tim Burton, sorry, bro.
So with the news of this film being made and the casting of Timothée Chalamet, needless to say, I think that it was clear across this table that there was quite a bit of hesitation. Not only in how the success of this film was going to be made, but the reception of it as well. Because we have several friends who are in the industry as well as we are, and they had gotten a chance to see earlier screenings than we had. And the conversations that were coming out of these screenings were, oddly enough, quite positive. Even some of the more skeptical people that I knew in the journalism, industry were giving it slightly good marks, like people who are very difficult to please and people who really have no trouble, giving the truth in all aspects of film. They were saying this was a good movie. And that scared me because it's like, I didn't expect it to be good. And I don't think anybody here expected it to be good at as well.
No.
So let's talk with that said, jumping into this review. Obviously, the movie's just released within the last couple of weeks, but we are going to be talking about spoilers. Although, if you've seen Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, or Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, you kind of know where this is going to go eventually. So, spoiler alert, nevertheless, you've been warned. First and last, only warning. Spoiler alert. Let's talk expectations. Now, we've all seen the original Gene Wilder, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, as well as the Tim Burton remake, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. So, knowing that lore, as well as the information in the books, if you've read the books, and I say books plural because there's two of them that are around this particular universe by Roald Dahl. Let's talk where your guys' heads were at coming into this film. And I want to start with Amy because I think Amy is probably the most versed both on the, mainly on the literary side. Maybe not so much on the film side. Well, I'm pretty sure you've seen it maybe once or twice.
Which one?
Either.
I've seen them more than that.
Well.
But thank you for that vote of confidence.
I literally gave you the literary credit. So yeah, just so take it with what you will.
You're a vicious canid. Anyway,
Romanoff.
So,
yeah, deep cut there. Take that.
You jerk. Anyway, so in regards to this, I do have a pretty deep and abiding affection for the 1964 Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, the book, as well as the 70s adaptation of the movie with Gene Wilder, which we've already said. So to say that I was hesitant when they announced another Wonka-esque movie, considering that I believe the Tim Burton one came out in 2004.
I think around then.
2003, 2004. And I remember seeing that and how much of a shift that was, not only from the original story, but also the way that it kind of, Tim Burton went to set it apart from the original. And that felt more of a retelling to Gene's story. So coming into this, I was like, I don't know. And then on top of that, with Timothée Chalamet, I was very, very, very like, when even in the trailer, they were showing him singing and dancing, but they weren't having him sing, I was like, unsure. So, going into this, I was just like, I'm going to try.
Yeah.
I'm going to try.
Spencer, will you please try, apparently.
So. Okay. So, like, several years ago, I remember hearing the announcement of a Wonka film. I'm like, yeah, it's going to flop. And then I heard that Timothy Chalamet was in it. I was like, okay, well, I don't even know what to think about that, so whatever. And then, you know, fast forward to coming out like this month, and I was like,
yep,
it's not even on our schedule, so I don't care. And then it suddenly became on the schedule, and I was like, oh, okay, I guess I care about this slightly more. And so that was the beginning of this movie for me. Was I heard good buzz on the side, but I'm like, this seems like it should fail.
I mean, quite literally. It's really true, because like, you take something that is as precious to many people, such as Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, and you take everything that is so incredible about it, like the actual sentiments that you get out of that movie, the wide-eyed wonder that you feel, even if you're old or young, you know, watching the film and loving everything that Gene Wilder has put into that film, as well as what people, like the stories coming out of the people who have been touched by that film. Learning, you know, all the depths that Gene Wilder wanted to give his character and the stories that had come out from the set, you know, the stories from like how Gene Wilder and the actor who played Charlie Bucket spent time together and hung out, and there's photos of them smiling and laughing, and it's like, you know, these are special moments created because of this special film. Now you take all that, and then you come to the understanding that they're wanting to create not only a prequel, but a prequel with somebody whom I personally don't have the most experience of watching in Timothy Chalamet.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of Dune, and he was in like The French Dispatch. Honestly, I didn't really see a lot of his.
In The French Dispatch, he's not a big role in The French Dispatch. He's only in there for a little bit, and yeah.
Same thing with like with Lady Bird. He was in Lady Bird.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
But it's like, yeah, well, and then he plays the son in the first third of Interstellar.
He's the son.
So I mean, but they're all parts that don't really give you a good range, if you will.
True.
And Gene Wilder created this character that literally is a spectrum of the character itself.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted people to, obviously everybody knows this story about, you know, what Gene Wilder had agreed upon with the director regarding his entrance into his first introduction to the people, and him coming out with the cane, and then him getting the cane stuck intentionally, and him falling and doing that last minute flip into, you know, that roll into the pop-up, ultimately wanting to create the sense that if people watch this and see that happen, then everything that happens after this will be unexpected to them. Like, that creates such a dedication to the character, and that's going to be hard to be met with, you know, especially if we're looking at somebody who's going to build to Gene Wilder.
True.
So it was really difficult to kind of see the connection. And to be honest, like, Timothy Chalamet, he's a good actor. However, some of the trailers were kind of giving me vibes of like overly hammy, like, oh, it was going to be too, you know, like an overcooked ham. It was going to be too well done, like too overly done. Like, you were going to have a bunch of like forced humor and stuff like that. Like, that was a sentiment I was getting.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes to the transitioning over into our first impressions. This is definitely in the realm. I think Amy had mentioned it the other day of Spence's, what was it? What'd you say? Trailer misfires or
yeah,
the trailer lies or something.
Yeah, the trailer lies 100%. I was actually talking to you, Spencer, because I had just finished seeing it, and I was like, "Oh my gosh, Spencer, you need to see this!" And then I was like, "The trailer lies. The trailers lie." Like, they weren't they didn't give enough context or even kind of like, it's just weird the way that it lined itself up. Because this trailer, even though, yeah, it shows some moments, it feels like it's going to, it doesn't feel like the Paddington 2 trailers feel, even when you see those. Mm. This feels like it's just too much. Like, it feels as like it's way too much, right? Like, and simultaneously not enough, which is something that we've talked about consistently with trailers.
Yeah, that was also my problem, is that, like, they're just showing, like, lots of, like, just snippets, but mm-hmm. not enough to really, like, even get a sense of what's going on.
Yeah.
And, like, I feel like this is the worst way to lie about something, is to make your product seem worse than it actually is.
Didn't we have an experience like this year?
Earlier
this
year,
I could have swore we had something that come up where we were like, the trailer did not do it justice at all.
No, this happened relatively recently.
Very recently, but I don't remember. We've been suffering this month, so I can't tell. But it was like, it was really recently too, where the trailer was just hot trash. And we're like, no, this was actually good. But yeah, this did no justice or diligence or any kindness.
Now I gotta look for this.
to anybody. But so what was your first impression, Eddie?
I didn't give it. I passed it over to you.
Oh,
I think we ended up talking about the trailers.
Yeah.
But if we're going with a first impression, I have been going through therapy, and it's easier to admit when I'm wrong without being sarcastic. And I can say I was wrong. Like, this is actually a good movie. It is not, it takes a lot to knock Paddington 2 down any steps, and it takes a lot to compliment without overshadowing 1971's Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. Especially, it's Gene Wilder. Like, there's only so many people when you just say a name and you're just like, it's them. And this, I was wrong. And I'm excited to talk about it more and be more wrong and excited. So, Spencer, what's your impression on that?
Okay, that's interesting, because we came to, like, the same conclusion but different ways. Because, like, well, yes, I would also say I'm wrong. I would also be like, this is not my fault. This is their fault.
Exactly. Exactly. I am with you. I will support that.
Yeah, that was, because I was like, this movie is so much better than that trailer implied that, like, I would be annoyed. Like, you're not fired, but, like, you need to go to a class or something. Because, like, I don't know what happened there. That was very confusing.
Was it Haunted Mansion?
No. I mean, their trailer was meh.
Although it might have been Barbie.
Barbie. No.
Was it Barbie?
No. It's somewhere in that vein.
Though. Oh, no, I remember. Mm. Elemental.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
that was it. Because you were very upset about
it. I was very upset. That was Disney doing us wrong.
Yeah, because I remember Elemental, like, I didn't get Immigrant Story from the trailer.
Yeah, no, nobody got Immigrant Story from that. Hey. Amy over here pulling it out of God knows where, but nobody was getting Immigrant. Like, pushing up, like, I definitely got the Immigrant Story. It was very much nuanced.
You didn't get Love Story.
Nobody got anything out of that. Out of the trailer. That trailer was horrible. Yeah. That was, like, the worst cut that they could have done for that film. Yeah. Ever. Like, they must have gotten the same person who did Endgame to do that trailer.
This is Element City. And then she's just walking around about that. And we're like, we don't understand anything besides your girl named Ember and there's a boy named Wade. And that's it.
It's like opposites attract. Oh, no. What's going to happen?
It wasn't even opposites attract. They didn't even give you the full opposites attract. They were just like, hey, this is her. She's fire girl. This is him. He's water guy. Ha-ha.
They're in hot water this year on Disney.
Okay, yes.
I mean, you could have decommed that really well.
That would have been such a horrible movie. but, like, I feel like this just goes to show again that there is a, like, balance between trailers, between giving your entire movie away, looking at you, Madam Web, and then not saying a dang thing, which is Wonka.
yeah.
I mean, yeah, it was like, hey, he's, you know, a chocolatier and he's young. He's going to be in a city. They're singing. There's dancing.
He's going to be in a city.
but that's literally what it felt like.
No, it's true. It's 100%. What about you, Spencer? Did you give me first?
He did. It's okay. All you.
My first impression, honestly, like, it's literally on par with all of you guys in terms of, like, I am blown away how wrong I was about this movie.
We're going to mark that. How wrong I was about
this. This year, 2023, is a year of admitting wrongs, because I happily admit that Elemental was fantastic. I was wrong about the thoughts about the trailer. This movie, I was wrong about the thoughts about how the movie was going to go based on the trailer. Mm-hmm. There were so many parts of this. I mean, even Asylum Month, I actually thought it was gonna be a lot worse. I was wrong in terms of how, you know, it wasn't as bad as I thought, and I enjoyed myself. Like those types of things, I have no problem admitting that pertaining to film. And so when it came to this one, I am happily willing to admit that I was wrong. This movie is definitely something substantial and a very impressive notch on the legacy of that which Gene Wilder and the team behind the original Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, you know, what their efforts were done for that film.
Yeah. And considering also that Gene, for years, when people were like, well, what do you think if they do a remake of Willy Wonka? And he's like, I can't support that. So we know he would have been like, sorry, Tim Burton, you outie. But for this,
without a doubt.
But for this, I think he would have been really, really hesitant, but he would have liked to see where it was going and the way that it turned out. And the fact also that Roald Dahl's great grandson. Yeah, he's one of the producers, and they worked hand in hand with him. And then this has an actual endorsement from the Roald Dahl estate, because other things after that, first Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, after that, nobody got like stamps of approval. That says a lot. Like, yeah, a lot.
Does. Yeah.
Well, I think that's what, like, you said it earlier, that like this movie complements that movie so well. Yeah. That like I think that's probably the most shocking thing of this whole experience, besides it even being a watchable movie,
yeah,
is that it fits right alongside of it.
Yeah, and it doesn't, and there's no space of overshadowing. And I think in part, not only is that the story, but definitely the acting. Like,
oh yeah,
100%.
Yeah. Which that brings us transitioning over into our next, you know, conversation piece, which is talking about the performers. I we'll get to Timothy Chalamet in a bit. I kind of want to start with like the lower tiered individuals that are on that list, including the likes of.
I want to bring up Goddess Divine Olivia Flippin' Coleman.
Olivia Coleman, yeah.
Can we talk about 4-time BAFTA winner, 2-time Emmy, 3-time Golden Globes, Academy Award winning Olivia Coleman, who was hilarious still carried menace. She embodied her crazy, like, all I can remember, she's Mrs. Scrubbit.
Yes.
Yeah.
She had as much whimsy and menace as a like a solid good villain without being so just like ridiculous. You can't believe her. Like, she balanced so well, and I have such a, like, a deep and abiding respect for her. Also, she's Helena Bonham Carter's like BFF. It's just the cutest flipping thing.
Well, and you have her acting, you know, alongside Tom Davis, who's a very big alumni in the Paddington series, with he plays Bleacher, which is kind of the they're kind of like a dynamic duo for crime, for their like pyramid scheme type little hostel kind of thing.
It's not a brothel.
I mean,
it's their like cleaning slave house or something. Yeah. Like, and he had a BAFTA breakthrough award, but also he was from Paddington too, which his name is T-Bone, but he's one of the guys in the prison who I just kept calling him Panna Cotta, because that's his entire thing. But he does such a great job too. Like, they complement each other without, like, it's just enough ridiculous, just enough silly, and it's so flippin' well balanced, which is something that you need when you're coming at a, because this is supposed to be for families, but also when you're taking children to see this, like, you want there to be menace, but not so much that they are crazy afraid. And there were still some great silly points in it, like when he becomes the Baron whatever with his
with his shorts,
and then when they've decided to pursue a relationship and he's wearing the little teeny tiny robe, like, it was so silly and endearing for me.
Also, Kayla Lane, who played Noodle, the young girl, she was a really great actress. I don't think I've seen her in anything else, but, you know, she was phenomenal in the role. She played great alongside Timothée Chalamet, as well as the other ensemble cast. Looking on the other side of the spectrum with our villains, you know, Matt Lucas, who played Prodnose.
His mustache was a bad choice.
I liked it, to be honest.
That was a Hitler stash on Matt Lucas.
Well, it wasn't. He wasn't Hitler, so thank God that was the case.
Thankfully.
Matthew Bainton, who played Fickle Gruber, and then you had...
Patterson Joseph.
Patterson Joseph, who played Slugworth.
Who he was great. Yes. Like, fantastic. Just fantastic.
I think they all three of them played alongside, and we can't forget Keegan-Michael Key.
Yeah,
as part of that villainous grouping. They played such a great level of villainy with a very fair scoop of silliness as well in it.
And they sang and danced.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, some of those harmonies, I was like, oh, boys. Thank you. Good job.
They really did a great job of creating, not kind of like what Amy mentioned, not such a villainous trio of individuals where they were scary, but enough menace to create that fear and know that there is something formidable on the other side of that, you know, good and evil spectrum. And then Keegan-Michael Key. Keegan-Michael Key. Aside the fat suit that he had to wear by the end of that film.
It got bigger and bigger and bigger. My heart was just like, oh my Lord.
He was wonderful to watch in this movie. I appreciated him in this movie. His humor, because nobody, this isn't a movie that you're going to take seriously. Like in terms of like, oh, you know, it's super drama, whatever. He's having fun with it. They're having fun with it. Mm-hmm. Obviously, because Keegan is a veteran in the comedic affair of the industry, not only in terms of, you know, verbal comedy, but even physical comedy. He knows how to make a scene work, and he does it every time he's on scene. I love watching that scene towards the tail end when he's trying to get out of the car.
And all the stuff just paper falls out.
And he literally says, the car shrunk. And I'm like, no, that's... no. And then, of course, you had... on the other side of that, you had the oddly surprising and wonderful work of Timothée Chalamet. I have to admit, I was concerned at first, but he was not at all as hammy as I thought he was going to be. Mm-hmm. The trailer cut him to seem like he was a ridiculous caricature, if you will, of Willy Wonka, of Gene Wilder.
100%.
And it looked like he was trying too hard to make those mannerisms work for him, when in all actuality, there's so much spread on his performance that he does those moments interspersedly throughout good performances overall. Like, yeah.
Yeah, I feel like the trailer made the mistake of being like, hey, this is the same character, and we're going to show you all the cuts of him being like Gene Wilder, which was definitely the wrong move.
It was definitely the wrong move.
Because then it doesn't show you any of him being his own character.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's, I think, sorry, because there's so many amazing actors and actresses in this. I'm literally scrolling and like, the person that played the Countess was actually like, she's actually royalty. And like, there's a whole bunch of stuff. But in regards to...
Not to mention Rowan Atkinson.
Yes. Oh, Rowan. But so with Timothy, it is, again, they painted him so poorly. And seeing him with the spread that he did, where his performance was without guile.
Yeah,
it was earnest. And I think that he didn't have like amazing, oh my gosh, we're going to lose our minds vocals. But it paralleled what Gene had, which was a sincerity in his interaction with his co-stars, the little bit of the unexpected. And then when there's so many homages and small ticks that you see where he took enough care to go like... The way he walked and he swung his cane.
Mm-hmm.
There were things that Gene did that I watched live in him. And then it would disappear for a few moments. And then like we'd go to a different scene and I'd kind of forget about it. And then it would suddenly pop back up. It was such an endearing understanding of where he knew everything came from. and what he was bringing to the table. He never truly lost himself in the part, and he was never truly foreshadowing where he had been. And I think that's a mark of somebody who is somebody to watch for an actor. Like, that's...
Well, I think that's... After everything we have seen Timothée Chalamet do...
Which isn't much yet.
which isn't much yet. I mean, he's got a lot of film credits under his belt, but nothing of leading wise. Outside of Call Me By Your Name and Dune, obviously, there's not a lot in the realm of whimsical and fantasy. And, you know, you look at the original Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, and you think whimsical. You think fantasy. You think children's books. I mean, obviously, if it's coming out of the world of Roald Dahl, there is a ton of whimsy in this, as well as tongue-in-cheek and humor that not only, you know, can, you know, make it work within the children's spectrum, but also transcends even to some adults. Candy is dandy, but liquor is quicker, kind of thing. Like, kids aren't going to understand that, but you know what? Adults are like, oh yeah, he's right. Yeah. And I think with Timothée Chalamet, creating the imperfect sense of confidence that we see in Gene Wilder, and watch that bud at the exact moment where, and everybody knows it when they're watching the movie, seeing that bud just blossom into not Gene Wilder itself, but the man who is going to become Gene Wilder in this movie, that is literally only because of the ability and capability and subtle nuance of Timothée Chalamet. And you were right on the money with that mention earlier about the little subtle nods and whatnot, because I mean, there was times where he did these little things, and he did like the tap of the cane on a post that was right next to him. And you knew exactly that was kind of setting up the mindset for when he does. In all honesty, points, yeah. This whole movie is about the buildup of pure imagination. The movie, I mean, the song. It is literally creating the framework for what that song means, and not just about a big room full of candy and whatnot, but the idea of pure imagination based off of what you can dream. And this movie kind of begins to build that for people who maybe had a sentiment of it when they watched the first film, maybe have an idea of it because they love the song. They've heard it in this movie, Ready Player One, anything else that they've played it in.
It is such an iconic song that all you have to do is hear the first couple of notes and you know what it is. And I think there's a handful of songs literally where you can hear the first bar and a half.
When I was,
that's a perfect example where where this is an example of the first 1 to 2 bars, and generations know what that is, know who that is, know where that is. And it triggers not only where you were and what you were doing, but the sheer awe of that moment of hearing it. And it's something that will make me cry.
It's not just the song recognition, but creating that belief in the song of what that song means, even translating the words of that song into a whole different other meaning as to how this film, you know, portrays the song when they finally put words to it and they start singing it. It's a beautiful scene, and it's like pure imagination doesn't just have to, you know, revolve around the idea of like a candy room, whatever. It can be whatever you drew. It sounds like we're kind of going around in circles, but it's because the fact that this song is so well developed as the foundation for what Willy Wonka truly will become and turn into, as what we see, not just in the book, but as what Gene Wilder would have wanted us to see. Like, I feel like this is a great homage to everything that Gene Wilder put out there for that performance in that film, you know? And talking about story-wise, the story is very, I don't know if you guys got the mentality of it, but it was very Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them kind of mindset, like the whimsy, the ability to just pull things out of nowhere. Like Wonka's hat is literally Newt's suitcase.
It's Mary Poppins bag. It's got that and the briefcase or the traveling chocolate factory, which I loved seeing. Mm-hmm. There are props in here who under anybody else's tutelage would not have felt so organic in that world. Mm-hmm. Because there's such an aspect of realism in the way that we're presented and everything else. And you're like, okay, Wonka's a fantastic guy. I get it. And then when he shows up and it actually meshes and it feels like genuine, you're like, oh, okay, that's cool. Yeah. Like, because for a long time, especially in the 71 version, the only thing you really can believe is that the magic happens inside the factory. That's the only place that has ever existed. It's the only place that these fantastical things can happen. Because we have that lead up with Charlie and everything about the world and the way that it's appearing and everything, and nothing becomes magical until they get through that gate. And seeing that the magic was always there, mm-hmm. and it's wherever he is like, oh, that's a really nice tip of the hat. No pun intended, sorry.
The story does involve, and I didn't skip it by accident. I just it is part of that story. So to kind of put it quickly, Willy Wonka shows up in this town, wants to start a chocolate store, factory, chocolate business, is run out by the cartel because they run the
chocolate
whole thing.
Cartel, not the regular cartel.
I just said the chocolate cartel.
You just said the cartel. Okay, I'm just making sure. After that giraffe yakuza, need to make sure the chocolate cartel is
the chocolate cartel. It runs him out pretty much. He finds himself in a predicament where he becomes indentured to this scrub house where he has to work off his debt for staying one night due to not reading the fine print, and then becomes in this crazy harebrained scheme of breaking out, trying to sell the chocolate, make enough money, get a space, but things happen. And the chocolate cartel has a lot of hands in it with the chief of police and the church.
Yes, there's which is Rowan Atkinson.
There's got to be some kind of satire there, just saying, or parallel. And then, so that whole situation, ultimately, obviously, Willy Wonka comes out, on top in the end and establishes his chocolate empire. Now, through the course of this story, we did not forget to include one particular piece of information, which is kind of vital to the Wonka story, and that is the introduction to the little people of the Oompa Loompa Land, Loompa Land of the Oompa Loompa that goes by the name of Lofty at the beginning. You find out he has another name at the end of the movie, played by Hugh Grant.
Who hated it passionately.
That is why I kept it to the end, because of the fact that he has...
You didn't hear this?
No, he has spoken about it at length, stating things like it was... He's
torture. He called it torture. He hated it. He said, but I have a lot of children and I needed money. And the reason Paul King picked him... Because in the books, the Oompa Loompas are actually like the OG, if you get one of the originals, they are so...
They're essentially African-Americans in the storybook.
Well, the very first
version. In the very first iteration.
Yeah, in the very, very first iteration. And before they become orange with green hair. But literally, they are those songs from the original movie, they are taunting the kids. Like, they are straight up just being like, you're bad. And Paul King said, who do I know that is absolute expletive that I could get to cast in this? And he goes, Hugh Grant. Hugh Grant would be
Which
great.
Hugh Grant has come out and stated that he gets it now. He's the only roles he gets are the villains, the weirdos, the monsters, the freaks, things like that. His quote, mind you.
It's because people are still like...
It's because he's become a curmudgeon. The man has... Oh, he deserves it. For all the cringe that he has done throughout his entire career, he has earned the noble right of being every single living monster in every film from here to Kingdom Come.
The Gentleman?
He was a monster in that one too. Mm-hmm. He was a curmudgeon. He deserves... I mean, for Love Actually alone, he deserves it. Okay?
You haven't even seen Music and Lyrics.
Notting Hill.
Yeah, I have.
You've seen Notting Hill.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Take it easy there,
Chief. Oh, my goodness. Come at me.
But either way, Hugh Grant, he is a very interesting... He is the ham of this movie. And whether or not he'll admit it, he was having fun in his role. However, he's a very... very proud Oompa Loompa in this movie.
Very, very proud.
They make him very much like a vendetta driven individual in this movie. And it works out all the way up until towards the end when he kind of has a change of heart. But Hugh Grant's cringe. And he's scary.
Yeah, but I feel like he worked well here because he was scary.
And if
you're trying to go with the route that these Oompa Loompas should be mildly on the scary side,
he was scary.
And mean side, then I think he did a great job.
Yeah. I apparently there's information out there. Hugh Grant had stated that the director, Paul King, quote, sent me a mock-up of the Oompa Loompa stark naked, and my little children were a little alarmed at that. The director added, it was one of the most disturbing things I've ever seen in my life. If it ever leaks out, a generation of children will be scarred.
Hey.
Adults will be too. Number one, the fact that they have a relationship like that, I don't know if it's like mutual, but Paul King is like, I'll send them pictures of naked little people. Why not?
Okay, I don't understand why we even made that in the first place. That doesn't seem like that's going to be helpful with the movie at all. I mean,
it makes you wonder, like, what he did when he did the Paddington movies.
No, you don't.
I do.
No, you don't.
Comparisons with Paddington and the Charmin bear.
Yeah, exactly. See?
Oh, my goodness. This story did enough of a... I had to track in my brain.
Amy's stuck there for some reason.
The story really did. It didn't go overboard in the ham department.
No.
It didn't go too far into sentimental, like, diatribe. It balanced on such a fine edge where some of the one thing that I'd seen a couple reviews of people that had been kind of critical of it, where they said that it lacked the same bite and fright, like not bite and fright, but the same bite or the same, I don't know, sense of maiming children's psyches as the boat tunnel from the 71.
Well,
Slugworth in the tunnel, or yeah, like any those things that made it so scary. That's where they were like, well, this isn't scary enough. And I think that says a lot more about
the expectations of people out in the world as opposed to fans of wanting to see the story develop properly.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody wants to see Saw for children again, you know, and yes.
We're adults first, now. We still don't want to see.
The first film was very unique in what it presented. There was a lot of additions to the film that really didn't sit well with the censors, but they did it. And it's out there now, you know, like the chopping off of a chicken's head and all that kind of stuff in some of those scenes.
That's right.
You know, there was a lot of things that passed the censors, even things that weren't necessarily noticed right away. There's a ton of like people who have, because of 4K, you know, and whatnot, people are looking at like the different titles on the rooms that they're passing by. Some of them have very unique names, very risque names,
which is on par for Roald Dahl as an author.
Which, let's be very honest. I mean, if there's even like within the Roald Dahl lore, if you look up what a schnozberry is, in the Roald Dahl book, I believe, or in the Roald Dahl universe of language, I believe a schnozberry is either the male member, or I forget, but it's pervy, but they included it in the story,
which is even funnier when Gene Wilder gets so excited and the way he delivers the lines. Like, I think that's in trying to balance the history, the legacy that is Roald Dahl. King and his team really took efforts to make it as inclusive but still as whimsical as they could without going down to crazy town.
It is. So a schnozberry is a fictional word that refers to a penis. It's an innuendo in the Charlie and the Chocolate Factory where Willy Wonka makes children lick wallpaper that tastes like
schnozberries.
Pee-pee. So And mind you, that has been out since, that information has been out since 2012.
Okay, so this is literally the first time I've ever heard of that.
Wait, seriously, about the schnozberries?
Yeah, never heard of that before.
A schnoz is in a nose?
Yeah, but
and
I would...
And a schnoz that's got berries?
Get that.
You know.
That gets me the boogers, like, not that.
So, yeah, it's that's kind of where it falls at. Let's talk highlights and issues. We've talked about the story. Like, let's talk highlights.
Can my issue be the snozberry?
Your issue can be a snozberry.
I mean, you can, but I mean, it's not in this movie. So let's talk. Were there any highlights or issues you guys had pertaining to the story overall? Let's start with Amy, because Amy looks like she's already prepared.
Well, the story, but the story overall is like,
Well, with the story, the film altogether.
The film altogether, I mean, I just really want to go rewatch it, so I think that might be an issue for myself and not really anything problematic. A lot, I feel, this is a minor gripe. I feel a lot of the story was dependent upon Noodle to kind of continue to drive it, because Wonka flits in and out. Even though we are following him, it's also really tied to Noodle. And having a child kind of be the support for Wonka, like, the whole time. And the other thing also is we can't really tell what Wonka's age is. And the sequence when they're dancing on top of the zoo and it's the song that Noodle starts to sing feels kind of like it has almost a romantic overture instead of like a friendship. He's, you know, opened my eyes and made me remember that anything can happen and it's a good thing. His Timothée Chalamet's verse is very kind of just like playful, like it's not anything sketch, but hers
Chalamet
seems...
not main
sorry Chalamet
he's not Arthur royalty, just saying.
He could be
Arthurian royalty.
He could be but hers seemed a little more romantic-esque, which could just be the way it was written or was delivered. That was my minor gripes. My highlights, there are so many highlights. And if I'm going to zero in, I'm going to just try to zero in on one.
Please.
Very respectful. I think the first time that we see him open up his traveling chocolate factory and he makes his first chocolate for Noodle, the entire sequence is brilliant. But watching the extra care and all of the tiny bottles and what's in it, and then him explaining it, and he's so nonchalant. But you watch it move. And then he's also giving you an additional backstory, which is just even more brilliant to listen to him do the narration and knowing what's happening. It has such delight. And I just need to see this movie again. Yeah. Yeah. Spencer, you got some stiffs?
Really quick.
Yes.
To your question. So about the schnozberries.
Why are we even going back to that?
So
he wants to poke them.
Dahl revisited schnozberries in his 1979 novel My Uncle Oswald, which is an adult novel about the quote-unquote the greatest fornicator of all time. And when talking about one of his rendezvous quote-unquote with someone, they ask him, how did you manage to roll the old rubbery thing on him? There's only one way when they get violent. Yasmin said, I grabbed hold of his schnozberry and hung onto it like grim death and gave it a twist or two to make him hold still. So
this gives me the vibe of Mean Girls when someone tried to make fetch a word. Like, we don't make fetch a word. We don't make schnozberry a word.
So it's already a thing.
The other thing that's really kind of not acknowledges, as much as Roald Dahl wrote children's books, he also wrote adult books and adult stories, and they go all over the place. Much like Shel Silverstein.
Shel Silverstein used to work, used to write for Playboy.
Yep.
Okay, so I'm finding I know nothing about these people. And it's okay.
These are people who have written your childhood books. So
yes. Interesting.
Great. Yes.
So as you were saying,
your issues highlights, movie?
Yeah, really my only issues are starting to come into the conversation. So highlights. When I leave a movie and I immediately go to look up your album for your movie, you've done a fantastic job.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, because there's like a few songs where I'm like, I really like, You Never Had Chocolate Like This. That's a really good one. Mm-hmm. And also, I'm lost. The one that the villains sing, tried to corrupt the cop.
The Sweet Tooth. Do you have a Sweet Tooth? Which has that three-part harmony that lays over in the middle before they get the fans. Oh, my life. Which was so good. Like, that sequence in and of itself, too. But the way everybody kind of sneaks up on it. No, I was trying to remember for a minute, and I was going to say that Slugworth was somebody else. Like, I can find him. He's in one of the Paddington movies. But the other officer, Affable, he's the warden from Paddington 2.
He's the one reading the storybook at the end of the evening.
But yeah, that sequence, the lighting, the costumes, the entire use, like, ugh.
Yeah, so the Sweet Tooth number, I feel like, is probably, like, the standout one, because like I feel like everything just gelled really well. Plus like the little bit of ridiculousness that like brought it all together, I thought was fantastic.
Yes.
And then I think this is just like a side highlight. I really liked the monks. Like when
the chocoholic monks.
The 500 chocoholic monks.
Especially when like Rhode Addison's just getting there and he's like talking to them and they're all like answering him like
in unison.
Gregorian chant.
In Gregorian chant, yeah.
I was like, that is solid right there.
I would go to a church like that. You know?
Yeah, they get corrupted by chocolate.
Yeah, I already am. So.
It's Rowan Atkinson. We were already corrupted.
If Rowan Atkinson was the priest and everybody was corrupted by chocolate, I am in 100%.
Such ridiculous.
Exactly. Just have him do a whole sermon on Mr. Bean and I'm good to go. So.
Which he does. Some of the moments when he's taking a bite of chocolate, he does the faces, like the Mr. Bean.
No,
faces.
That's just his face. Rowan Atkinson just does that. If there's an incredible stand up that he did that was like, I want to say it's almost 2 hours long. It's on YouTube, but it is so fantastic because you get a chance to see all the full range of Rowan Atkinson in his comedic genius. The man is a flippin' genius when it comes to creating not only just verbal comedy, which most people are more apparent of his nonverbal comedy with Mr. Bean, but as well as his nonverbal. He is quite witty, funny. He is just a delight to watch. So, yeah. Since I've already talked about Rowan Atkinson for a little bit, I'll say that one of my highlights, because I believe you're... Did you finish yours?
Yeah, I'm done.
Okay.
I was ending with the monks.
Gotcha. Again, seeing Rowan Atkinson on screen again since the last time we saw him was like Johnny English Reborn. Like, it's been years since we've seen him on the big screen. And I love watching him. I love seeing him on there. I really wish that he would have came back and did Zazu in the live action remake for Lion King. Although, what's his name? Not John Stewart. John Oliver.
Yes.
John Oliver did Zazu well in the remake. He is just a delight. He is so much fun, and seeing him in a more nefarious role, so to speak, was absolutely just, it was wonderful. Between him and the performances from not only Timothée Chalamet, but the crew that he worked with, the other scrubbers, the other people who were working in that, they were just wonderful, and it was such a lighthearted opportunity. It's like a lighthearted Ocean's 11, seeing how everything worked in the film. It was just so great. The only issue I guess I had was kind of Hugh Grant, but it's just as a person, not really as a role. So, but other than that, I mean, because how do you go after creating a film like this and go and complain about the role you did to that degree? Jim Carrey had to take CIA training, torture training, just so that he could sit in the chair, but he doesn't say negative things about his role as playing the Grinch.
He can literally manipulate his entire face to do the Grinch smile.
But
sitting in there to do the fuzzies and everything, oh my gosh.
But like, he was fully in makeup and whatnot, and he doesn't like besmirch the role. He doesn't talk down about it. Maybe he needed the money. Maybe he needed X, Y, Z, whatever it may be. But he's not negative about it.
No,
you know?
It's because Jim Carrey had a class and this guy doesn't.
Thank you. Yes, very well. Thank you. Very well put. I feel like Hugh Grant is in a new stage of his career that he just needs to accept. Because he's no longer the cheeky playboy that he feels like he still is, either in cinema, in the film, or in real life. He is cringy now, and he needs to understand that he can't get away with those things anymore. And there's no shame in that. There's no shame in growing with your capability and your ability as a performer. You know, if you can still do certain things, then make it work to the audience that expects to see it. But if you're going to keep trying to do all the cheeky things that you did in the early 2000s, late 90s, early 90s, late 80s, you're probably not playing to anybody who wants to see it anymore.
True.
So get over yourself and just have fun with it, you know? And speaking of having fun, I do have a roundtable question for you guys tonight. Now, although Timothée Chalamet did a great job as a title character, my question to you guys is, if you had an opportunity to create a fantasy cast for the role of Wonka, who would you choose? And we're going to go ahead and start with Amy, because I feel like Amy already has one in mind.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, boy.
I wouldn't.
You wouldn't?
No, I wouldn't pick anybody.
Well, that's not really how this works.
No, no.
So I asked for a fantasy cast, not a option as to whether or not would you or wouldn't you.
Young Gene Wilder. Like, that's not an option.
Well, that was my fake option.
Yeah, exactly. See, our fake option is either young Gene Wilder. But the thing I think that's most genuine about this is that in putting Timothée Chalamet in the driver's seat for this, he has moments where he is... like, he feels like he is kind of connected to Gene Wilder. So I don't think there's a higher praise. And to be honest, I don't know if I'm willing to take a risk on somebody else even attempting.
We took a risk on Timothée Chalamet. Why wouldn't you consider anyone else?
Do I want Tom Holland in that? I don't think Tom Holland's going to bring the same type of energy.
Is this your choice?
My
She's
choice.
Going with Tom Holland. Got
no,
it.
My choice is I don't want anybody else in the role for
but
a
you know
Wonka.
That this is going to happen again.
No.
Yeah, no. It will. I have no doubt.
Know.
No.
They for did this one. I'm pretty sure they're going to want to talk about the glass elevator at some point in time.
But that's late Willy Wonka. That's Gene Wilder Willy Wonka. And in that case, we don't do it.
So if there was an in-between, who would you pick?
Older Timothée Chalamet.
Okay, so what you're saying is if they wanted to do a glass elevator thing, mm-hmm. we bring back Timothée Chalamet in like 30 or 20 years or whatever.
It would have, well, see, that's the thing. The Charlie and the Great Glass Elevator takes place immediately after Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. So the Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory movie. So when they go up in the air, mm-hmm. that's literally leading into them going into outer space. So you have to get right there. And at that point, I'm sorry, Gene's already gone. We're not taking anybody else.
I'm still looking at that eventually blah, blah, blah. But I'm talking about pertaining to this film.
I just like Timothée Chalamet and I'm going to stick with him.
You're no fun. Wow. Okay.
Yay! We're bringing back young, undead Gene Wilders, right, Spencer?
Well, I mean, the movie studios are going to be able to do it in the next few years.
Oh,
so.
Crap.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Crap. I don't
want
to.
So I'm taking
world.
Spencer that you also have a non-answer as well.
No, I have an answer.
You actually have one.
Yes.
Thank God somebody actually has one. Okay. Go ahead, Spence.
All right. So,
thank you for playing the game.
Yes, of course. But you're probably going to get disappointed all over again.
Well, it's an answer. So, you know, it's.
Okay.
Interns will be interns.
So my answer is going to be Shuri Gatwa.
Basically. You know what?
Willy Wonka's a doctor. You really think
that? Oh, without a doubt. I mean, without a doubt. That cane is very well a sonic screwdriver. You know, so I like that.
The elevator is just a TARDIS in disguise.
I like that. You don't count over there in the corner.
No,
over
but
there
I'm
like,
just acknowledging and propping up that.
Which
not
I just recently realized, and I didn't realize it prior to, that Shuri is in Barbie.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I was over my folks' house this morning and someone was watching it on TV and I was like, that's the doctor. Hold on. That's the doctor.
Actually, months ago, I was like, oh, this is going to be like the first thing I see him in. So I was like looking out for him in Barbie.
It was so good.
I feel so, yes, I feel like Timothée Chalamet did a great job mm-hmm. in this role. Now, if I were to consider someone maybe maybe not so much around the same age as Timothée Chalamet, because I believe Timothée Chalamet is like in his early 20s, but around that age to where in about 10, 15 years time would get to Gene Wilder, I would pick two different people. Now, mind you, I love Spencer. I love your idea. I really do. I would, if I had my choice, it would either be Elijah Wood, because I feel like Elijah Wood would knows how to bring that kind of fun to the table. And it's been a while since we've seen him do some stuff, and I'm pretty sure he could pull it off. But if not him, I would say my other option would be Paul Dano. I feel like Paul Dano has enough nuance to his character, and especially after his whole Riddler incident with the Batman, you know, I feel like he can do also kind of unhinged slightly. Yes. But interesting. I could see Paul Dano filling in that role as well. But also in that same breath, I concede both of those choices and go with yours, because I feel like that's just a great option. I love that thought. I mean, even, oh, you know, it'd be so cool. But then he would have to have like an English accent, like David Tennant, as like, like, since we're on that role, like David Tennant would be a great Willy Wonka. But either way,
I stopped by David first, but then I was like, oh,
but his Scottish accent is just so there. And it's like, you know, Gene Wilder, American, Timothée Chalamet, American accent. I don't think he's American, though.
He's French.
So he's French. I
mean, Chalamet.
Well, I mean, I mean, we got LaCroix in the U.S., and that's bottled in Florida. So just yes, because it has a name, just say it.
Wow.
Wrapping this thing up. Let's go ahead and go around the
Anyway, are you physically calling Timothy Chalamet like Florida backwater?
Florida French water, let's be honest.
She felt better. He was born in New York.
See? There you go.
But he has New York he's a City. Dual citizenship, France and the United States.
Wonderful.
Already lies, though.
There you go.
He speaks French and English. It'll count.
There you go. Well, you speak vulgar and American, so it all works out.
What the heck is your problem? All of this is pot shots at me. Gosh. No.
Let's go ahead and go on the table and start with Amy. Does Willem Dafoe fell in how many Monaco? You kind of said yourself.
You weren't. So this movie passes for me. If there was ever a question of that, I was gushing right after I admitted I had been wrong, which is something I
don't ever do. Period.
I choose very delicately when to, and I'm happy to say that this is one of those films that encompasses and creates a companionship with the original, I don't want to say historical film, but the original film. You can watch one
the and first
watch,
iteration of the
well,
book.
You can watch one and the other, and never
just don't watch the Tim Burton one.
Are you done?
I'm just saying, don't watch the Tim Burton one.
Remind me to get in the middle of your.
You
yours.
Do all the time. Go ahead,
Spencer.
I'll remind you.
Thank you. Okay.
You too on that side of the table.
So this really does complement what it's trying to do, what it's trying to say, and where it's going. And I think the nod and the slow build of the hill to finally get to pure imagination is a worthwhile not only endeavor but a true labor of love and a great homage where homages for any type of homage, including the changes that they created to build into this world. I can't speak highly of it enough. And for me, capping out a year, this sucker, you coming along with my Paddington 2 ride, I'm going to give you a 5 out of 5, Wonka, which doesn't happen often. And it's not rose-colored, I'm seeing clearly.
Spencer.
So this movie passes for me, which is something I did not think I was going to be doing when we started this endeavor.
Ain't that the truth?
This movie is just really good. Like, I guess I'm just shocked that, like, it wasn't a cash grab, which is sad in one way, but, like, it makes me hopeful that, like, you know, maybe someone somewhere has learned something. And maybe not everything has to be a cash grab. You know, like, this is going to be my manifestation for Hollywood. Mm. It doesn't have to all be a cash grab. Make something of substance, you know? And this movie has a lot of substance. There's lots of likable characters. Even the villains are fun to hate. I mean, Olivia Colman. Oh, my gosh. Mrs. Scrubbit was just fun to watch each time she just showed up. Mm. So I was very happy with her. And even Noodle, there's not really, like, if I were to flip this to who did I not like,
Hugh Grant.
But I liked how he was dumb.
And he was a butthole.
Yeah. So, like there's something of value in, like, just pretty much everything in this movie. Mm-hmm. So, for me, it's going to be, like, a 4.5 out of 5.
Nice. Mm-hmm. It's
a very well done movie.
Well, as for me,
Amy, this is your point to interrupt.
Yeah, okay.
No, okay.
I'll figure out when to do that.
Hold on. You can do that right now. There you go. So, in regards to the film itself, the film passes. I turned you completely off. In regards to the film... the film passes for me. It is absolutely wonderful. I had...
You're killing Spencer by doing this.
It was the only way.
You have to rebound in the mix.
No, I don't. In regards to the film passes for me. It absolutely is a wonderful work and homage to the original. Spencer's actually dying over here.
I told you.
You know what I love listening to a podcast? One-sided conversations.
Exactly. Especially when you produce. In regards to the film, it obviously passes. It's a great homage to everything Gene Wilder, everything that has been done back in the 70s, and everything that makes the books so wonderful and lovable. In regards to the monocles, I'm going to give it a 4.5 as well. I really do feel like this movie absolutely just... it's a joy to watch and a surprise as a cap to the season of suffering, which we all thought we were going to suffer through this film. But
much
oddly
like
enough,
I am right now.
What's that? I can't hear you.
Yeah, I know you can't, you jerk.
Much to the surprise and pleasant surprise of all of us here, this movie really does bring together the mindset of, you know, you can't really judge a book by its cover. And regarding the season of suffering, I feel like this is a great way to cap off this season. As it comes to a close, much like Spence, outside of Hugh Grant, who more of a personal issue in terms of his overall character outside of the film, I feel like, you know, the movie is a must watch. And if you have an opportunity before the year is out, check it out at your local theaters. But this movie is going to get a 4.5 from me as well. And I highly suggest people go and see it. So. Yeah, but that about wraps up another awesome episode of The Filmlosophers. Remember, you can check us out wherever you listen to podcasts, whether if it's iTunes, Google Play, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, or iHeart. You can tune into your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Give us a follow at The Filmlosophers. Give us a subscribe. Let us know how we're doing. Drop us a line in the comment section. And if we're doing well, give us a 5-star review. We've earned it.
We have.
I'm suffering still.
Yes, as she speaks. We also are on socials at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter, Instagram, and Threads at filmlosophy101. There on Instagram, you can also catch all of our great zany extra content such as Spencer's Big Score and Amy's Jane on Scene, which can be found where?
The only place it's ever lived, which is at Jane on Scene on Instagram and Instagram only. And I need to post that I finally saw Cliffhanger and I have issues, Spencer, with people not wearing cold weather gear in the snow with the wind. But yeah,
so that'll be something to look forward to in the new year.
A real cliffhanger. Okay.
A real cliffhanger about Cliffhanger. You can also check us out at our website at filmlosophers.com. There we have allegedly over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy. Our first volume of Season of Suffering, which was in what year, Amy?
2021.
That was a very long way to say that.
I couldn't remember if it was
2021. There you can catch our first iteration of that, as well as other great content over at our website at filmlosophers.com. We are now coming to the end of the year, and this will be our last episode for 2023.
Thanks.
So, of course, we want to make sure to let everybody know thank you for coming along for the ride for 2023. Thank you for being alongside us as we had our ups, our downs, our move-ins. Like, we literally started recording in the studio this year. And so it's been an array of different things going on in our lives. But the one constant is that you, our fellow listeners, are always there and willing to give your input, and we are thankful for that. So as the new year comes in, we look forward to great things in 2024, and yeah, more movies, more reviews, more content. So from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
Still 23, intern Amy.
Class dismissed.